Hello, and welcome to this week's RTD Health. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Elaine Hill, reading the health section from the April 22nd issue of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Today's first article is titled, Spare Parts, Kidneys, Eyes, Ears, and More, A Look at Our Body's Natural Redundancy, written by Dr. Robert H. Schmerling of Harvard Health Publishing. One of the many underappreciated things about the human body is that it has a lot of excess capacity. That is, our organs have more reserve than most of us will ever need. It's as if our bodies were designed with the idea that we might need backups in case of illness or injury. And voila, when all goes well, we arrive at birth with two kidneys, not just one. Of course, the kidneys are not the only example. So, why are we built with natural redundancy? And which of your body parts can safely fail or be removed without impairing your health? Why do our organs have so much reserve? The likely answer is evolution. Early humans with a genetic makeup that produced organs with functional space to spare were better able to survive, thrive, and reproduce than others without such a genetic makeup. As a result, genes associated with excess organ capacity, remember, two kidneys, not one, were more likely to be passed down to future generations. Meanwhile, evolutionary ancestors without as much reserve may not have survived long enough to reproduce, and so they weren't as successful at passing their genes along. Over thousands of years, this power of natural selection has led to modern-day humans having organs with plenty of reserve. What are some of the body parts with reserve? First, kidneys. Most people can live perfectly well with only one kidney. That's why people can donate a kidney to someone in need. However, the remaining kidney must work harder, and the risk of future kidney failure does increase somewhat. In addition, an injury, infection, or other disease affecting the remaining kidney can lead to kidney failure more quickly than usual. The eyes. You can be perfectly healthy with one eye, though you may miss the depth perception and larger field of vision provided by having two. Even losing both eyes does not directly lead to poor health, though obviously blindness can pose challenges and impact quality of life. Additionally, studies suggest that significant vision impairment may raise the risk of Alzheimer's disease. The ears. Though having two ears allows us to locate sounds from all directions, losing hearing in one or both ears doesn't immediately impact overall health. But as with vision loss, quality of life can be diminished by hearing loss. And as with vision loss, recent studies suggest that people with hearing impairment are at an increased risk of developing cognitive problems. The gut. Relatively large portions of the small and large intestines can be removed without having a major impact on your health. In fact, the entire colon can be removed, an operation called pancolectomy, without shortening a person's life, though digestive symptoms may follow. Removing a section of bowel is a relatively common operation, for colon cancer, for example. But the removal of part of the bowel doesn't itself impair health or shorten lifespan. The lungs. When necessary, an entire lung can be removed, and you can rely on the other lung and function quite well. A lung may be removed due to a tumor, but occasionally it's done because of infection or emphysema. Lastly, the liver. A relatively large portion of the liver can be removed, assuming the rest of the liver is healthy, because there is so much reserve liver tissue and because the liver has an ability to regenerate. Does this mean parts of our bodies are expendable? Maybe. If you're only considering survival, you could view many of our body parts as expendable. Indeed, you could survive without your spleen, much of your liver, your eyes, your ears, a lung, a kidney, and other parts. But clearly, there are factors to consider other than survival, especially quality of life. So no one would suggest parting with even the least useful organs without a good reason. Millions of people worldwide owe their very survival to the fact that our organs have so much redundancy. And living organ donors can give up a kidney or a portion of another organ to help others live well and still be healthy. So even if some parts aren't absolutely necessary, it's good to know there's so much reserve available. You never know when it might come in handy. And that concludes our first article of today's reading, titled Spare Parts, Kidneys, Eyes, Ears, and More, A Look at Our Body's Natural Redundancy. This article was written by Dr. Robert K. Schmierling of Harvard Health Publishing. Dr. Schmierling is a senior faculty editor and an editorial advisory board member for Harvard Health Publishing. Next in the health section, the column titled The Medicine Cabinet, Ways to Reduce Ringing in the Ears Today, written by Dr. Howard Lewine of Harvard Health Publishing. Question: I have persistent ringing in my ears, mostly in my right ear. My hearing test showed mild hearing loss. What can I try before spending money on hearing aids? Dr. Lewine responds, you are one of the estimated 15% of American adults who suffer from tinnitus. For many, it's a high-pitched ringing, while for others it sounds like whistling, whooshing, buzzing, chirping, hissing, humming, roaring, or even shrieking. It may be constant or intermittent, steady or pulsating. While there presently is no cure for tinnitus, there are many ways people can manage it so the symptoms do not disrupt their daily lives. Tinnitus commonly begins in older age and has a close association with hearing loss. It also may occur from long-term exposure to loud noises, a medication side effect, or simply something as simple as earwax buildup. It's unclear what happens in the brain to create the noises. One explanation is that the auditory nerve, which connects the ear to the brain, begins to fray, diminishing normal sounds. Neurons in the brain's auditory processing center compensate for this loss by becoming more sensitive. The sensitivity knobs get turned up so high that neurons begin to respond to the activity of other nearby neurons, which creates the perception of a sound that does not exist. Here are some techniques that may help to reduce the symptoms. First, learn your triggers. Write down the circumstances when tinnitus symptoms bother you. It helps you to anticipate, prevent, and change situations that may make tinnitus worse. Try a masking device. This device looks like a hearing aid and produces sounds, such as nature sounds, that make tinnitus seem quieter. The sound distracts the brain, and tinnitus symptoms become easier to tolerate. But you don't always need a fancy ear device to mask tinnitus sounds. Listening to music or white noise helps distract your brain so you pay less attention to the tinnitus. Exercise. Regular physical activity can reduce the frequency and intensity of tinnitus and the distress it causes. Try mindfulness. A program called Mindfulness-Based Tinnitus Stress Reduction builds skills in deep breathing, yoga, relaxation, and meditation to help a person deal with tinnitus. Mindfulness programs have been shown to reduce depression and anxiety while improving social functioning and overall mental health in people with tinnitus. Consider other therapies. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help you identify negative thoughts about tinnitus and reframe the way you think about and react to tinnitus. Tinnitus retraining therapy uses counseling and sound masking to help the brain relearn hearing patterns so tinnitus is less noticeable. And that concludes our column, The Medicine Cabinet. And the article today was addressing ways to reduce ringing in ears, written by Dr. Howard Lewine of Harvard Health Publishing. Dr. Lewine is an internist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. For additional consumer health information, please visit www.health.harvard.edu. Next is our column, The Savvy Senior, and it addresses what to do about Medicare and Social Security when you move. Question: next month, I am moving to a different state so I can be near my daughter and grandkids. Do I need to notify Social Security and Medicare about the move? And the answer: yes, if you're a Social Security and Medicare recipient, you definitely need to let these federal agencies know when and where you move so there are no hiccups in your benefits or coverage. Here's what you should know. How to update your info. If you're receiving Social Security retirement, survivors, or disability benefits, it's required that you notify the Social Security Administration when you move to ensure your deposits continue and you avoid disruptions. You'll need to provide them your new mailing address so they can deliver important documents to you, like your annual SSA 1099 tax form. And if you're switching banks or credit unions, you'll need to update your direct deposit information by providing your new financial institution's routing number and account number. If you're a Medicare beneficiary, they too need your new mailing address so bills, correspondence, your Medicare summary notice, and other statements can go to the right address. You can update both your Social Security and Medicare contact information online by simply using the My Profile tab in your personal My Social Security account at ssa.gov/myaccount. If you don't have an account, you can create one online for free in just a few minutes. Or if you need some help or don't have internet access, you can call Social Security at 800-772-1213. That's 800-772-1213. Or visit your local Social Security office and they will make the changes for you. Medicare private plans. You also need to know that if you're enrolled in Original Medicare, you can move anywhere within the United States without losing coverage. But if you have Part D prescription drug coverage or a Medicare Advantage plan from a private health insurance company and you move out of the plan's service area, you'll have to switch plans or you'll face losing coverage. Part D service areas typically are statewide or can extend to parts of neighboring states, while Medicare Advantage plans service areas vary by county. Moving out of a plan's service area qualifies you for a special enrollment period, known as SEP, of at least 2 months to get a new plan. You may also qualify if you move within your plan's service area and it offers options different from what you had. The enrollment timing depends on when you notify the plan. If you tell your plan before you move, your chance to switch plans begins the month before the month you move and continues for 2 full months after you move. If you tell your plan after you move, your chance to switch plans begins the month you tell your plan plus 2 more full months. To shop for new Part D and Medicare Advantage plans in your new area, use the Medicare Plan Finder tool at medicare.gov/plan-compare. You can also switch Part D or Medicare Advantage plans during open enrollment, which runs each year from October 15th to December 7th for coverage starting January 1st. Medigap plans. If you're enrolled in Original Medicare and have a Medigap supplemental policy, you usually don't have to switch plans if you move, but you do need to notify your provider. Some insurers let you keep the rate based on the state where you originally applied for Medigap. Others may change your premiums to coincide with their coverage in a different zip code. And that concludes the column Savvy Senior, and it discussed what to do about Medicare and Social Security when you move. This article is submitted and written by Jim Miller. Send your questions to Savvy Senior, P.O. Box 5443, Norman, Oklahoma 73070, or you can visit SavvySenior.org. Jim Miller is a contributor to NBC's Today Show and author of the Savvy Senior book. Continuing in reading from the Richmond Times-Dispatch health section, we will read from the People's Pharmacy column, written by Joe and Teresa Graydon. Question. My father and I have both suffered with canker sores all our lives. I've heard of eating kiwi fruit to speed healing, and in a recent column, you wrote about sauerkraut. A few years ago, a dental hygienist told me that canker sores are caused by sensitivity to sodium lauryl sulfate, known as SLS, a foaming agent present in many but not all toothpastes. Since I changed toothpastes, I have dramatically fewer canker sores. Even when I bite the inside of my mouth, the sore spot clears within a day instead of the 2 weeks it used to take. SLS-free toothpaste has made my life more pleasant. The author's answer. You are not the only reader who has told us that avoiding sodium lauryl sulfate reduces the likelihood of canker sores. There is surprisingly little research addressing this topic, given that so many products containing this foaming agent. One systematic review in the Journal of Oral Pathology and Medicine of May 2019 of the medical literature concluded that use of SLS-free toothpaste helped control amphus ulcers, also known as canker sores. Question. What's your assessment of the value of lithium to prevent dementia? Answer. There have long been hints that lithium might be valuable to reduce the risk for dementia, and that's a publication titled Progress in Neuropsychopharmacology and Biological Psychiatry, published August 30th, 2006. However, most research has focused on anti-amyloid drugs such as aducanumab or lecanemab. A systematic review turned up a number of animal studies, but only a few clinical trials of lithium for Preventing Dementia. And that's from the publication Aging Research Reviews, March 2024. Doses studied vary widely. When lithium is prescribed for bipolar disorder, doses range from 600 to 1800 milligrams daily. Adverse effects may include diarrhea, muscle weakness, drowsiness, changes in thyroid function, and kidney damage. Much lower doses, like 10 to 20 milligrams of lithium orotate or citrate, have been used experimentally against depression and dementia. The risks may be reduced at such doses. Much more research is needed on this possible treatment. Question. I am aware that over-the-counter OTC pain relievers have side effects. However, two different orthopedic surgeons and a sports medicine doctor have all downplayed the risk of ibuprofen and or naproxen. They recommend that I take one or the other daily for pain and swelling in my knee or hip. The sports medicine doctor was openly hostile when I said I wouldn't take ibuprofen as often as he recommended because I am concerned about the health of my kidneys. My two older siblings, who both have had knee replacements, have been advised by their primary care physicians that they can no longer take any ibuprofen because of reduced kidney function. Another sibling who worked at a kidney center saw firsthand the horrible things that happen when your kidneys give out for any reason. I imagine it is hard for doctors that they don't really have any safe and effective options to offer their patients in pain. Answer. You have identified the Achilles heel of anti-inflammatory pain relievers. In addition to damaging the digestive tract, chronic use of drugs like ibuprofen and naproxen can be hard on the kidneys. There is also a risk of elevated blood pressure and cardiovascular complications. Sometimes natural remedies can be easier on the body. We describe a number of herbal approaches in our e-guide to alternatives for arthritis. This online resource can be found under the Health e-guides tab at www.peoplespharmacy.com. And that is the conclusion of the column, The People's Pharmacy, written by Joe and Teresa Graydon. In their column, Joe and Teresa Graydon answer letters from readers. You can email them via their website at www.peoplespharmacy.com. And finally for today, our closing article is titled, Processing Has Its Place, Putting Everyday Food Choices into Perspective, written by Julie Corliss of the Harvard Health Publications. Make no mistake, eating plenty of whole or minimally processed foods is considered the best strategy for keeping your heart and the rest of your body in good shape. We're talking about vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, and nuts. But processed foods definitely belong on your menu too. Anything that changes food from its natural state is considered processing. For some foods, processing makes them safer. For example, pasteurizing raw milk, says Dr. Chi Soon, associate professor in the Departments of Nutrition and Epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This type of minimal processing doesn't substantially change the food's nutrient content. Other examples of minimal processing are chopping and freezing vegetables and fruits and roasting chicken. At the next level are processed foods, which have a few added ingredients. Examples of these foods are canned vegetables packed in water and salt, freshly baked bread, and peanut butter. foods that are processed so much that the original food often isn't recognizable are ultra-processed foods. They include additives such as preservatives, oil, sugar, salt, coloring, and flavoring. Calories or something else. The main problem with ultra-processed foods is that people simply eat far too many of them. More than half the calories in the average American's diet come from ultra-processed foods. Perhaps that's because many of them are sweet or salty carbs, like cookies and chips, that are easy to overeat. One small but carefully controlled study found that people tend to eat about 500 more calories per day when offered mainly ultra-processed foods versus mostly unprocessed foods, even when the meals contained equal amounts of major nutrients. According to a review in Advances in Nutrition, ultra-processed foods are linked to a higher risk of diabetes, high blood pressure, unfavorable blood lipids, and obesity. Some research hints that certain additives used in processing, such as emulsifiers, which help fats and liquids blend together, play a role in raising cardiovascular risk. Another theory suggests that ultra-processed food may damage the microbiome, but the evidence is still evolving, says Soon. Is processing the problem? Instead of focusing on how much a food is processed, pay attention to the food's basic ingredients. For example, some ultra-processed foods made from whole grains and dairy, including breakfast cereals and fruit-flavored sweetened yogurt, aren't necessarily unhealthy, says Soon. Yes, less processed alternatives, such as rolled oats and plain yogurt with fresh fruit, are healthier. But in three large observational studies done in the United States, ultra-processed whole grain bread, breakfast cereals, and yogurt were associated with a lower risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. In contrast, sweetened beverages, processed meats, and ready-to-eat dishes were linked to higher risk of those conditions, Sun says. While it comes to cutting processed food from your diet, replacing soda with water is a good first step. And don't forget that even some minimally processed foods, such as red meat and butter, aren't good for cardiovascular health, says Soon. Ready-to-eat dishes or microwavable frozen meals come in handy for people who don't have the time or inclination to cook, and they're often a better option than fast food. Look for choices that include whole grains and vegetables and healthy protein sources like beans, low-fat dairy, chicken, or fish. Make sure the meal contains no more than 500 milligrams of sodium and is low in saturated fat, less than 10% of the total calories. And that concludes the article, Processing Has Its Place, written by Julie Corliss of Harvard Health Publications. And that's all the time we have for Richmond Times-Dispatch Health this week. I'm Elaine Hill for the Virginia Voice. Thank you for listening. This program is always available anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.